Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Finance Z Podcast, episode 19. Before we start today's episode, I wanted to give a thank you to today's sponsor, Magic Mind. Magic Mind is a healthier alternative to starting off your morning with a bang of energy. The magic ingredients in the drink shot include organic matcha, turmeric, vitamin C, vitamin B3, vitamin B complex, and much more, all allowing for you to be more efficient and effective throughout your daily activities. Magic Mind is easy on the stomach and tastes amazing from my own experience. Be more productive with Magic Mind, and you can do this by learning more about Magic Mind at magicmind.com or click the link in the description of today's episode to buy some of your own. Now, let's jump into today's episode. Today, I am joined by another fantastic guest, Mr. Tom Gotch. Tom's had a fantastic career in the finance world with over 8 years of investment banking experience. Tom is currently a director at TD Cowen, one of the top investment banks in the world. Tom began his professional career with Raytheon Technologies, where he was a program manager for 8 years before transitioning to MHT Partners, which was eventually acquired by Cowen, and Cowen was recently acquired by TD Bank. Tom holds a bachelor's and master's degree in industrial engineering from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. In addition, Tom earned his MBA from UCLA Anderson School of Business. I'm very excited for our chat, so I hope everyone is excited to dive deeper into the world of investment banking. Tom, welcome and thank you for joining the Finance Z podcast.
Thank you, Logan. Thanks for inviting me and happy to be here.
So before we dive deeper into your career at Cowen, I'd love to learn more about your early career experience. So upon graduating from Cal Poly with an engineering degree, you joined Raytheon Technologies as a program manager for a few years. What did you learn from your engineering experience and how did that eventually lead you to deciding to transition into investment banking?
Sure. Good question. So I actually joined Raytheon as an engineer and then stayed at the company for about, as you said, about 8 years prior to entering business school. I love my time there at Raytheon. It was a great place to start a career, and I still have a lot of very close friendships that I made at the company while I was there. I'd say, answering your question related to what did I learn from my engineering degree or how did I apply that at Raytheon? I'd say, first and foremost, it's problem solving. And I'd say that's what an engineering education provides you more than almost anything else. It's your ability to break down a problem and figure out how to find a solution as practically as possible. Your ability to solve problems at Raytheon, keeping costs in consideration is, I think, what led me to in part stand out as I kind of moved up the ladder there at Raytheon. I'd also say, I learned a lot about professionalism and being a good team member. It's something that I think is inherent for Cal Poly students and Cal Poly alumni, just because you have so much project-based work, you are very, very adept at working on teams and working with people different classmates across, different courses. And so I think you have an innate ability coming out of Cal Poly that I noticed not everyone does out of other schools. And so I also, having recruited folks, would say that's a core aspect of Cal Poly students that is pretty unique. And it's what recruiters are looking for out of Cal Poly students, mm-hmm. is that they know they will be pretty well polished. I think, another thing I learned is the value of a positive attitude. That's something that I think, as you start your career, you're often, very positive and relatively outgoing. I think, pulling that, holding on to that as long as you can, as you enter your career is really helpful, and having a can-do attitude and saying, yes, absolutely, let's figure out how to get this done, is sometimes different, you'll find, than folks who've been working for a number of years. And some folks will find reasons why they can't do something, right? So your ability to be positive, and think proactively about how to get things accomplished is oftentimes unique. And that's something that I learned at Raytheon, and certainly was part of my attitude coming out of Cal Poly. And then I think finally, time management. Obviously at Cal Poly, you have a lot going on. You have a lot of courses, and having said that, there's a lot to get done, but your timelines are usually a little vague and a little opaque, and they're a little artificial in nature. When you get into industry, you quickly find out that time management is very important, and your deadlines are there for a reason, right? And so you're trying to ship product, whether it's software or hardware, you're trying to get something out the door, and there's someone, usually leading the team, which is what I ended up doing at Raytheon as a program manager, where you're trying to get a whole cohort of people that are on your team that are working on different aspects of a project, and you're trying to get everyone to row in the right direction and to deliver a product at the right time. And so time management and focusing on deadlines is critically important. So I'd say that's, those are the core tenets that I learned at Raytheon.
Awesome. And obviously, you had an engineering background and you eventually made a huge career change, which was to join Wall Street and become an investment banker. So, I think we're all curious, what prompted you to want to make a significant career change? Was there a specific moment in your career that made you think, okay, I want to be an investment banker?
Yeah, I'd say at Raytheon, well, backing up a little bit, coming out of Cal Poly, I quite frankly didn't know what investment banking was. I hadn't really heard of it. So that was off my map. But while I was at Cal Poly, I had a strong interest in business and a strong interest in finance and accounting while I was there, even though I was an engineer. And I stuck with engineering, partly because I could do the work and partly because I knew it provided a level of optionality for me coming out of school where, I could do a whole host of things, with an engineering degree, where sometimes you're a little more limited, if you have, a different degree behind your name. And so, I had a hunch that I didn't want to stay in engineering forever. And in fact, I started Raytheon. I was an engineer for all of a year, maybe a year and a half, before I was plucked out and pulled into program management and really put in charge of kind of business tasks and business items. So that was sort of my early entrance into more of a business focused career. Even though I had an engineering degree and I could understand, what made me dangerous at Raytheon was that I had a lot of interest in business and understanding of how to make a team work. Yet at a pretty young age, I was doing that, say when I was 25 years old. But at the same time, I had an engineering degree that helped me understand a lot of technical terms and understand, what different aspects of the engineering groups that I was working with were doing, right? So what the electrical engineering group was doing, what the systems engineers were doing, what the mechanical engineers were doing, and what the manufacturing engineers were doing. So I think that's, one aspect of an industrial engineering degree that's fairly unique is you have a pretty broad perspective of engineering coming out of that specific program. And so getting back to your question of, what led me to make that switch, I was introduced to investment banking through the corporate development group at Raytheon, whom I worked with briefly. And once I learned a little bit about investment banking, I sort of latched onto it and I was really, really curious. And I just did a bunch of Googling and learned as much as I could. And the more I learned, the more I was intrigued by, the work they were doing. And so I, as I matriculated into Anderson, I knew that that was potentially one of the avenues that I wanted to pursue. It was either going into tech, where, it's sort of like Raytheon, but a little faster paced. Or it was going and making kind of a hard pivot into investment banking, which was certainly much different, but also offered a completely different skill set and allowed me to develop something that was new to my toolkit. And so I was very intrigued by specifically investment banking, so that I could build out kind of that financial knowledge that I didn't necessarily have as an engineer.
Absolutely. And kind of going back to your time at UCLA, when you were attending Anderson for your MBA, did you discover more of your passion for investment banking there? And how did you decide to go to MHT Partners compared to other more well-known investment banks? And how did you enjoy working at a boutique investment bank?
Sure. Yeah, coming out of Anderson, I would say, talking to classmates who either it Anderson's fairly unique because you have a lot of folks from varied industries, and everyone has different experiences, and they're all high performing people within those organizations. And so you meet and talk to a lot of classmates, and I think that was helpful for me to really figure out what I wanted to do coming out of Anderson, I'd say more than anything else. And so, while you're in school, be it undergrad or grad school, your classmates are one of your most important resources in terms of how you learn and what you learn. And so I think that instilled in me, a more defined perspective on investment banking. And then, as you mentioned, recruiting, I had a lot of opportunities coming out of Anderson. I was very thankful for that. It's a fantastic school, and there's a whole host of companies that come to recruit there. And so I had opportunities to go into tech, I had opportunities to go into management consulting, I had also opportunities to go into investment banking. Ultimately, I chose the investment banking path for a number of reasons. One being that there's only a couple opportunities you have to join investment bank in your life, and that's out of undergrad and that's out of grad school, where you can find your way into, technology companies and sometimes even management consulting, later in life. So I knew that if I really didn't like it after the first year or two, I could make a hard pivot into something else and go back into aerospace, go into tech, and maybe go some other direction. And then I was also very keen on working for a smaller company. So Raytheon is a, at the time was a Fortune 100 company, still is. I did an internship at Google, another Fortune 100 company. These are big companies with tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of employees. And you feel like a somewhat small cog in a really big machine, right? No matter how highly you perform. Investment banking is very different. You're on very lean teams with a small number of people, and you're working with a client. And so you see your work product, immediately having an effect on that client. And I think that's something that I gravitated towards. And I was really interested to work for a smaller company. And I had opportunities to work for a bulge bracket bank, and other much larger banks. And I purposely chose MHT in part because of its size. And, it was sort of this upstart investment bank. There's only a handful of folks at the time. And, we grew larger over time. And it was also filled with a lot of former Harris Williams bankers. And I had a lot of strong respect for Harris Williams and what they did, on sell side M&A work and whatnot. And so, nearly the entire team that I was going to be working with at MHT were all directly from Harris Williams and had started the firm coming out of Harris Williams. So, That was another aspect that I was attracted to.
Gotcha. Perfect. Yeah. No, amazing. And now I kind of want to transition more into your current company now, Cowen, and diving more deep into what investment banking is. So, do you mind explaining what is an investment bank? What are the different types of investment banks, their role, and how do they contribute to companies, the financial markets, and the overall economy?
Sure. I think this is a great question because for folks who are in high school or college who are listening to this, I think investment banking is fairly misunderstood by a lot of folks, and that's largely because it's somewhat purposeful in that way. I think the industry is a little opaque for people on the outside, and quite frankly, not a lot of folks have a friendly investment banker living in their neighborhood, right? That they can ask questions to. So, it's a career path that I think has a lot of misconceptions around it. And so, on a speaking broadly about investment banking, you know, what we really are really more like a financial consultant to our clients. And so I would think of us more as, you know, doing advisory or client-based work, more so than, you know, being a master of the universe or whatever people think that we do day in and day out. And so, investment banking is odd when I talk to, you know, my mom, who's a, you know, former school teacher, and my family, who are all also former teachers. You know, they didn't know what investment banking was, and they certainly had conceptions of what we were because we're not a banker. I can't qualify you for a loan, right? And I'm not an investor. And so I'm not actually using my own money or my firm's money to make an investment. So the name inherently is a little, I think, confusing for folks, but what we do is we're bankers for investors, if that makes sense. And so, typically our clients are either, you know, a company that wants to sell themselves or an investor that wants to buy a company, and we are the broker or the advisor that typically helps them do that. And there's other aspects of investment banking, but I think the core function of investment banking is really just being an advisor. So I think the easiest way to break that down is and something that I've used with my mom to explain what I do is you know, you think about real estate, right? And so you think about if your, you know, real estate broker helps someone either buy a house or sell a house, instead of buying or selling a house, we're a broker for businesses. So we help people buy a business or sell a business. And inherently, you know, that at a very high level, that's kind of all we're doing. But a business is a very different thing than a house. And so it's much more complex and there's a lot more that goes on to it. And, you know, I take what we do very seriously because it's people's livelihoods at stake, right? There's folks who are working for these organizations, for these companies. And so it's up to us to find the right home for a business, right? If we're selling it, or to appropriately, you know, acquire a business such that it can operate successfully going forward, right? And so hopefully that makes sense and is a fulsome or at least a high level explanation of investment banking and what we do. I'd say for full service investment banks, you know, there's different aspects. You know, there's mergers and acquisitions, there's equity capital markets, there's debt capital markets, there's leverage finance, restructuring. And then there's also, again, full service investment banks offer sales and trading, where you're working with institutional clients. And then there's also research. So there's a research component whereby those research folks have a Chinese wall separated from most of the other investment banking team, because they don't want our needs or opinions clouding their research and vice versa. So, Hopefully, again, that makes sense, but let me know if you have any follow-on questions there.
Yeah, and then obviously investment banks, they have a lot of people in the company, and there's a lot of different roles. So my understanding there is various roles of investment bankers. Do you mind diving into more detail about what are the different levels and the role of each person, such as an analyst, which would be the lower the food chain, versus a managing director, and how they play in executing deals?
Sure, happy to. So, like you said, there's an analyst. Typically, in most investment banks, there's an analyst, an associate, a vice president or principal. They can use those terms interchangeably, and then a director in some investment banks and a managing director. So that's the hierarchy. As you move up that role, so an analyst is typically someone whom we're hiring out of undergrad directly, and we're training them up. So our analysts go to sort of summer boot camp as soon as we hire them, and they go and learn literally in a classroom with all the other analysts. And we, for Cowen, fly them to New York, sit in a classroom for a few weeks, and basically learn everything they need to know about financial modeling using Excel. They go through practice sessions. It's very hands-on, and it's very, kind of project-based. And so what an analyst does day in and day out is they're in charge of, kind of the numbers and making sure that all the smaller tasks are getting done. They're also fielding requests from all the folks above them, obviously. And I think critical component is just making sure that, the financials tick and tie throughout all the marketing materials, throughout the financial model. And so they're sort of our feet on the street, the numbers folks, and they'll also sometimes work with clients directly, to make sure that we have all the data and that we've checked all the boxes, that, the data room is up to snuff, or all the files that we need to learn about the business are have been checked off. So they do a lot of the day-to-day tasks. And you're typically an analyst for 2 to 3 years prior to getting promoted to the next rung up, which is associate. The associate is obviously in charge of a lot of what the analyst does day to day. The analyst associate role is very tight. So typically you want an associate and analyst to work very closely together, be in the same office, ideally. And so the associate is sort of the quarterback for the deal. They're doing higher level work than the analyst is doing. They're drafting a lot of the initial marketing materials. They're interfacing with the client a little bit more. They're giving updates up the chain. And so that's where you're starting to manage up, and you also have to manage down. And so for a lot of folks, the shift from being an analyst to being an associate is a difficult one, because you have to learn both managing up and managing down. As an analyst, you're only managing up. And so the next role up is a vice president, or principal. Different firms, you could use different names, but really that person is, I'd say has a lot more client facing responsibilities. And their role is to manage, not just the day to day, but also to look ahead, right? And to look ahead, weeks and sometimes months in advance, and make sure that we're on the right path. That things are getting done, and to get ahead of work that is going to come up in the days and weeks ahead of time. So the VP role is really critical, and that's the first, I'd say, the lowest tier of what we call a senior banker, is the VP role. And vice president has a great title, but you're not a corporate vice president, right? There's lots and lots of vice presidents within any investment bank. And so the next rung up is a director. A director is really just a junior managing director, where, in that role, you're largely in charge of a client relationship, Often you're managing the client relationship during the middle of a process. The managing director ultimately owns that relationship, but you're working on the day-to-day and you're doing a lot of the communicating with the client throughout the middle of a process. And so you're making sure that, similar to a VP, but at a higher level, that everything is organized. You're checking all of the work that's being done before it goes to the client. So you're often the ultimate check before product goes to a client. Of course, the managing director is also doing that check, but you're the managing director is relying on the director to do a lot of that role. And typically, a VP and a director are, I don't want to say interchangeable, but there's, oftentimes on a leaner deal team, you'll have one or the other. You won't have both. And then, of course, you have a managing director. So the managing director is in charge of the client. They're in charge of fielding new work. And then they're also in charge of ultimately making sure that a deal gets to closing. They're doing a lot of the negotiation against a counterparty. And they're really, they're focused on strategy and kind of the big picture thinking and making sure that, things don't go off the rails. And when things do go off the rails, which they sometimes do, that they get right back on, and you get back on track. And so you're the ultimate decision maker. And, the managing director plays a big, big role in the success of a mandate.
Got it. Thank you for that information. And now, as you mentioned previously, investment banks are typically known for their roles in advising companies and, whether or not that be taking a company public or a different product group like M&A. So in regards to mergers and acquisitions, why do companies want to merge, acquire, or get acquired? Does a company come to an investment bank like TD Cowen and ask for the bank to research other companies they should, buy, or do they already have target companies in mind?
Yeah, I'd say the rationale for a company selling themselves or wanting to go to market is varied. In our group, which is private sales and investitures, but as a director within M&A, you work with a lot. I've worked with a lot of clients, and I'd say a lot of whom we're working with are owner entrepreneurs of businesses who want to sell a business for a number of reasons. So it could be a business that's 10 years old and you have a founder who has literally, maybe 99 to 100% of their net worth tied up in this business. And they want to take some chips off the table and sort of de-risk their asset matrix. And so they, want to find a partner, either a minority or majority partner to buy the business. And so sometimes they want to sell 100% of the business. Sometimes they want to sell less than that. And so we work with the client to understand what their goals are and what they want ultimately, and what they want their next, 3 to 5 years to look like. And so another reason for selling, is, sometimes a company gets to an inflection point, it gets too large and someone did a really great job building a business to get to, say 100 million in revenue or, 250 million in revenue. But to get to that next stage, they know themselves well enough to know that they need help, right? And so where they will sometimes want to sell all or part of the business to find a partner, and that partner they know will help them get to that next inflection point, right? To grow a $100 million business into $500 million or whatnot. And so that's another reason. Sometimes it's a founder entrepreneur who has since passed away, and the company's been inherited by, the kids or the grandkids, and they just don't have the passion for the business and they want to find a good home for it. And then you have, certainly we work with financial sponsors, so that being private equity groups, and family offices who have a portfolio company that they need to sell. So there's a defined hold period for a lot of these especially private equity firms, less so for a family office, where they can only hold it for a certain period of time because the fund that they've used to acquire that business has a defined period of life. And so that defined period of life is typically 10 years. And so after 5 or 7 years, they want to start a sale process so that they can, sell all of the portfolio companies within that fund. And so they essentially need to close that fund down, sell the businesses within that fund to someone else. And so also financial sponsors will sometimes that platform will get too big for them, and they'll want to sell it to a larger private equity firm to take over, so to speak. So those are all different aspects. Again, it's varied from kind of situation to situation, but we've seen all of that.
Got it. Now, having had, many years under your belt as an investment banker, what would you say are the most important skills that you believe an investment banker needs to have in order to be successful?
Sure. I'd say, the core skills are, I'd say number one, it's being intellectually curious. You need to be, you want need to want to understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then you also need to want to know about the businesses and the clients that you're working with. And so without that, I think it's really difficult to be good at what you do. You need to be, of course, detail oriented. So, you need to make sure that your writing skills are impeccable, right? Because when you interface with a client, you can't have misspelled words or misplaced words. You need to make sure that the marketing materials are, every I is dotted, every T is crossed. And within the financial model, you need to make sure that the numbers foot, right? And that just means that the numbers all align and match, right? And so you just need to be very detail oriented. I think you need to have, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, good problem solving skills. There's in any deal that you work on, there's very few that work seamlessly from beginning to end. There's usually a hiccup somewhere in the road. And so you need to think on your feet, and you need to, if a seller or a buyer asks a question, you need to be able to answer that question and or address the situation quickly and seamlessly. And so there's a lot of, being quick on your feet, but also fixing a problem when they come up, or helping a client fix that problem. And then I'd say the last thing is being a good teammate. Like I said, investment bankers work on pretty lean teams. You usually have, anywhere from, I'd say at the leanest, three and maximum six or seven folks on a team. And so you need to make sure everyone within that team has a defined role, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast. And so you need to make sure that you can trust everyone on that team and that they're going to have their role covered. And so, in a lot of ways, you're sort of like a SWAT team or like a special forces team, where you need to rely and depend on everyone around you. And because there's no one who can really be subbed in midway through, it's really difficult to do that. And so you need to make sure that you can depend on your team, and that you're a good teammate, and that everyone else around you is, equally a good teammate.
Absolutely. And now I kind of want to dive deeper more into your thoughts about, economic outlook. During most of this year in 2023, many economists and strategists believe that the US economy would fall into a recession due to the Fed rapidly increasing interest rates to fight inflation. And as we see now, long-term treasury yields are soaring, reaching a new high at 5%, I think this past Monday. However, in recent months, markets have rallied as inflation has dropped, unemployment rates have stayed low, and their strong consumer spending and outlook. I was kind of curious, what are your thoughts on a soft landing for the US economy, and how does that impact deal flow for investment bankers?
Sure. I can't give financial advice. This is strictly my personal view. But at a high level, as you mentioned, the Fed has increased interest rates at the fastest clip, one of the fastest clips in history, right? So they've increased rates at about 500 bips in a fairly short period of time. And so when you do that, the cost of capital becomes more expensive. And so any transaction that requires debt or leverage, and so those are synonymous, debt and leverage, will tend to slow down, right? Or at least cool off a little bit. And so that means that if you're buying a house, you need a mortgage, right? And you are getting debt with that mortgage. If you're buying a car, you're usually getting an auto loan, right? If you're buying a business, you're sometimes using debt. And so as the cost of debt gets more expensive, the interest payments get larger. And so, your ability to afford something, I would say, shrinks. And so I think what we're going to see and what we're starting to see is the economy slowing down, which is what the Fed wants, which is their entire rationale for raising rates, is to try their best to get ahead of inflation. You can make the case that they should have done this a little bit earlier, but they're following more or less the 2-year treasury. And so, as that rate went up, they followed their rates right behind. And they've been slightly behind the curve, but pretty much in lockstep with, as you mentioned, the rise of the 2-year treasury going up to 5%, a little over 5% now. So all of that takes time. And so what we've seen in the financial markets since that time is that it takes a while for the economy to digest those increases in the cost of capital. And so that's typically 12 to 18 months. And this is why it's always this imperfect process, right? What the Fed is having to do is very difficult because the impact that they have on the economy takes time to filter through. And so they don't often know exactly, they have some guardrails that they want to stay within, but they don't know how restrictive they need to be, right? And because that impact won't happen down the road, and it's not, they don't see an immediate impact. And so, we saw something similar in 1999, 2000, right? Where rates moved up, but for a good period of time, the stock market rallied as well. And the same thing happened in 06, 07. And eventually, those increases in rates, that increase in cost of capital, again, catches up with the economy and catches up with businesses, right? So a business, a large public business isn't able to raise as much debt as cheaply to buy back shares, right? So share buybacks decrease. All that to say, can the Fed engineer a soft landing? They certainly can, and they've done that in the past. I'd say if you look at the rate of increases, that being a lot of increases in a very short time, I'd say the probability of a soft landing is restricted. It just becomes probability becomes smaller that they'll be successful in a soft landing, but it still can happen. And so what we're seeing in the bond market is that you have an You still have an inverted yield curve. We've had that for over a year now. And it's one of the deepest, longest inverted yield curves that we've seen in my lifetime. And so when the problem doesn't start until the yield curve uninverts and things start to go back to normal. And so we'll see what happens when that yield curve uninverts, if we get a soft landing or a hard landing. But it's difficult to say. As far as what we're seeing as investment bankers, I think the market is normalized a bit. But we've still seen, at least in the middle market, lower middle market where I play, still good deal flow, and we're still very busy. So like I said, it takes time for that to filter through. So we'll see if things change in the future. But hopefully the Fed is able to kind of navigate what they need to kind of either change rates, decrease rates in the future or whatnot, but to orchestrate a softer landing. So again, we'll see. It's really, really hard to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you, and thank you for your insights. The last question I kind of want to ask you was, what career advice would you give to young students in high school or college if they would like to pursue a career in investment banking or engineering, and how to become successful?
I'd say, success is measured differently for different people. So I wouldn't say, you're successful for having gone through an engineering program or successful for being an investment banker. Folks could want different things out of life, right? And sometimes that's career oriented, sometimes it's not. I would say, what served me well is finding what you're good at, and following that. That may not be your passion, but what I do day in and day out as an investment banker, I really like it. I actually love it. It's the work is fun, it's genuinely interesting, and it's fun to work with clients and find good outcomes for them, right? And so like I said, to be a consultant and to see process that you see from kind of womb to tomb, from start to finish, is really satisfying. And I haven't been part of a transaction that's gone sideways or poorly, has ended poorly for a client yet. And so, I say sometimes a mandate will end for one reason or another, but the ultimate final outcome, finding the right place, the right home for a business, is really satisfying. And I think we've done, our team does an excellent job of sussing out and helping a client find that right next place. And so I'd say, finding what you're good at, and honing in on that, right? And turning that into your passion, whether you're passionate about it or not, is really, really important. And then for me, I think, creating optionality for yourself, right? Creating opportunities for yourself. Like I said, studying engineering created a lot of optionality for me and allowed me to focus on, what ultimately I wanted to do. And so it gave me a lot of leverage to at least find, what makes me happy day in and day out. I'd also say, something that's really impactful is to have grit, work hard. Nothing in life is easy, right? And to be successful is difficult. And whether you are born on first base or born on third base, I've worked with a lot of folks who operate at a very high level, a lot of great clients, CEOs and CFOs who they all work really hard. Even, if they've gotten to an inflection point in their lives where they can take their foot off the accelerator a little bit, they worked really hard for a decade or two, right, to get there. And so no matter what you do to be successful, I think you have to, again, find something that you're good at, find something hopefully that you're passionate about, but also work really hard at that. And you're gonna fail. I failed. I had small failures along the way, but having grit and finding determination to really get to get back up and keep going, I think is one of the most important things towards kind of finding success in life, right? And I'd also say finally, just embrace the rub, right? So by that, I mean, be humble, embrace feedback. You don't know everything about yourself. Embrace, feedback from other folks, and seek that out. As an investment banker, we do 360 reviews where, the junior folks review the senior folks and the senior folks review everyone else. And, you get a lot of critical feedback that's, usually very constructive and is helpful. And so, by embracing the rub, it means, you're not going to be polished unless you embrace core feedback from yourself, and from others, right? And that you take that and you build on it. And so I think, having that resiliency and, being humble in your career and being diligent, working hard are, all the recipes for success. I don't see how you can't be successful with by doing those things.
Absolutely. Well, Tom, firstly, thank you so much for your time and sharing your knowledge and wisdom of finance and careers to the next generation. I'm sure our listeners gained a lot from you. It was a pleasure hearing your story.
Great. Thank you, Logan. Really appreciate it.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning into my talk with Tom at Cowen. It means a lot, and I'm extremely grateful for you guys' support. Again, check out Magic Mind in the episode description to learn more about the healthy Energizer drink. If you like this episode, please drop a 5-star review on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe. You can follow us more for more updates on Instagram at The Finance Z Podcast. I hope you all enjoyed the episode. Remember, continue to grow and never stop learning.